you open up in the Chumash, you'll find the story of Esther towards the end. Megillat Esther starts on page 1252. Last week we discussed the relationship between Ahasuerus and Vashti. This week we are going to discuss the relationship between Esther and Vashti. And Esther very cleverly becomes the anti-Vashti. She knows what Ahasuerus found wrong in Vashti. She doesn't care very much to be the wife of Ahasuerus. Is not high on her bucket list. But she realizes that now she has been thrust into this position, at least after her conversation with Mordechai, she realizes that there is a purpose to this. Right? Mi yodea, who knows?
Mi yodea.
Okay. So she strategizes from that moment of how to make the best of where she is. And that's going to have to deal with knowing exactly what kind of husband she's married to, and to know exactly where he is, what his weaknesses are, and how to use her strengths in that matter. The greatest weakness of Ahasuerus is that he's hamolech mehoduva ad kush. He is not the son of a king. He is molech. That's a verb which means he basically crowned himself king. He appointed himself king. He rose to the throne. So we did that last week, is that we said she's Hamalka Vashti as far as she's concerned. She was born into royalty. He's not. Right? Think of another couple. We're going to get to this couple later. Think of another couple, I see Baruch is right on it, where the woman is born into royalty and she knows everything about the way royalty is supposed to go. And she despises the fact that her husband is treating the kingship with let's say, not the respect that to which she's used, the way he's dancing in front of the Aron. So she says, oh, this is the way a king acts. You're not anything like my father was. So the fact is, she didn't tell him that. But that's between the lines. How do I know it's between the lines? Because right after she tells him, that's no way for a king to behave. Well, out of nowhere, he says, "Well, your father isn't king anymore." You know, right? I know he can tell right away what she's saying. Right? She's saying, "I know better than you how a king is supposed to behave in public because my father was king." Right? Michal was the daughter of a king, the sister of a king, the husband, the wife of a king. Huh? She wasn't the mother of a king. That's a shame.
Yeah.
Her brother was Ishposhes.
Yeah.
I mean, Chazal say she did have a child, that she died in childbirth. Yeah. She did have a child. Anyway, so in this case also, Vashti knows what we call Tachsise Malchus. She knows how a king should behave better than Ahasuerus. Because her grandfather and her father were royalty in the nation, where page 1252. You pass down a few cuts, quickly. Were royalty in a nation where science was a very much sought after premium. Nebuchadnezzar surrounded himself with culture and science and chachamim, and Ahasuerus surrounds himself with drinkers, right? So, and men who have an emergency meeting of state or what to do about a woman who doesn't want to attend a party. So this is, you can see there's a difference between the two. It's not just men asserting themselves like Ralph Cramden. This is Persia asserting itself over Babel. Okay? So in that backdrop, Esther is chosen. She too is neither Persian or Mede, and she rises to the throne. So she is going to deal with this first weakness, which is Hamolech. The weakness is realized. Two people in the story try to kill him. Right? There may have been other threats to his life, but this shows that one thread is enough. One thread is the same as many. So he, remember last week we discussed that he originally had many, many officials surrounding him. He always took advice from groups. And then after the threat to his life, he only surrounds himself with one trusted person. And that happens to be a really bad guy. So Esther knows that her husband has a constant fear of the insurrection, right? Another point of this, and you can see this in some cases in Tanakh, is that an insurrection always starts with the queen, right? Mm-hmm. Think Hamlet, think Macbeth, think, if you will, when Adoniyahu asks Bathsheba, you know what I'm talking about, to beg Shlomo to marry, remember her name? It's a Haftorah. Mm-hmm. Haftorah of Parshas Chayisara.
The one who kept him warm.
Avishag. Correct. Avishag HaShunamit. So Adoniyahu crowned himself king, so he lost the kingdom. All right. Can I just get a booby prize? All right. So he went up to Bathsheba, Shlomo's mother. He won't turn you down. Just ask Shlomo, and she agreed to do it. Right? This was the woman that was brought in to keep David warm when he was very old. And it said, you ever get like, you get such a cold, nothing can keep you warm, no matter how many coats you wear, and you know, it's hot in the summertime and you just can't get warm. So that's how David was. So they found something to keep him warm. But he never really married her or anything, right? So, you know, there's just an amazing little Gemara there. The Gemara is, if you think that the Gemara just was a lackey for biblical characters, you're wrong. The Gemara was very, very, sometimes avant-garde and very thoughtful and very biting. And it's, this, you know, where it says that Avishag told David, you know, if you're the king and I'm your consort, we should be married. I should marry you. I want to be the queen. I don't want you to be someone who warms you up. So he says, no, I can't. I already have 18 wives. And the Gemara says that what that really was he goes, I have to atone for when I took someone I shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. Now I won't take someone that I can. Right? And so the Gemara in the second parak in Sanhedrin presents it. So remember, her response to him was that the ganav is too old to steal, and he blames his good behavior on his tshuva. Right? You have to be in the same situation in order to really do tshuva. So the Gemara, I won't get into the whole nitty gritty of the Gemara, but the Gemara goes on to prove that David was still able to do a perfect tshuva in that realm as well. The Hamevin Yavin. So, nonetheless, David did not was not intimate with Avishag. So, technically speaking, she is permitted to a non-king, right? I think, you know, the law that in England, I think it's still the law today, it was certainly the law in the time of the Gemara, that once a woman is married to a king, when that king dies, she's not allowed to marry someone else, right? Except, according to Rabbi Yehuda, another king who's not the son of this king, because then it's his father's wife, and that would be forbidden. But when you see what I'm saying, is that Avishag technically can marry someone else. So when Adoniyahu, David's Shlomo's older brother, who pretended to the throne at one point, asks Bathsheba for her hand in marriage, right, you with me on all this? This is a long-winded story here, to say that Shlomo thought that Adoniyahu's desire to marry Avishag, who wasn't even his father's consort at all, she was just like there in the room to keep him excited, and he killed him for that. Remember his reaction? Really? He wants to marry her, and now that tomorrow he'll want the kingdom. So here is Esther's plan. I'm going to plant the seed in my husband's mind that Haman wants the throne. Now she has to be very careful, because she knows her husband is paranoid, but she has to be careful with just how paranoid. If he is Stalin or Caligula paranoid, right, then he'll kill her for even inviting Haman to a private party, right? If he's like off the wall paranoid, where they, you know, like the current ruler in I think he's up to 1,200. He's killed 1,200 people in the government already since he assumed power a few years ago.
So
Ahasuerus, we don't see him killing his only inner circle. I mean, many things that are just not written in the Megillah, but Esther has to straddle a careful line between getting her husband just jealous enough, right, and not getting him too jealous, where, you know, he killed a wife just before me, right? You know, I don't want to be in her company. Okay, so here is her plan. She has to be careful this is a very, very important. Let's just find the place. It's a very important metamorphosis in her life. It's when Mordechai tells her that she has to do something, right? And it starts off with Pasuk Tet Zayin. Perek Dalet Pasuk Tet Zayin, 1256. Okay. She doesn't even know what her plan is yet, right? She's going to work on a plan. But when Mordechai finally convinces her that she has to do something, right? She says, "Leich kenos et kol ha'yudim, gather the Jews. I know that the only way this will work is if I feel that I have the people behind me, right? Hanimtziim b'Shushan, that are found in Shushan. V'tzumu alai. This is the first sign of real Yiras Shamayim immorality in the book, right? Everything else is okay. We're afraid we're going to get killed. So this is a real true Yiras Shamayim. Gather them, let them pray, let them fast. Al tishtu shloshet yomim laila v'yom. This is a 72-hour fast. That's a serious fast. Gaman even arosai atzum kein. I and my maidens will fast the same way. Uvechein avo el ha-melech asher lo kadas v'kasher avadati. There's a picture in the Sistine Chapel. I saw it in a book once. I've never been there, but of this scene. She looks very faint, and there's someone holding her up. In Medrash, who is that?
Gavriel.
Yeah. And so there's someone holding her up, and he saw her and felt sorry for her because she's, you know, you go and see the king, and you haven't eaten for 72 hours. You're gonna feel a little faint, right? Your face will look a little sullen and sulking or something. All right, So she goes this way to see the king, Kasher Avadati Avadati, because she tells him, the rule in Persia, mm-hmm. that you can't see the king unless you have an invitation or an appointment. And if you go to see the king without an appointment, your life is in your hands unless he gives you like a dispensation. You touch the scepter and that's your automatic, you know, your automatic way to... things are very very formal in Persia, right? You know, if you sign something with a ring, you can't rescind it. Chok v'lo yavor, right?
It's infallibility of the king. It cannot be one decision.
It's amazing, right? We can change it. We can, you know, we can do it with something else afterwards. But if I said it, it's undoing it means I made a mistake. I don't make mistakes, right? That's why in Daniel, when the king signs a decree that makes Daniel go to the lion's den. Uh-huh. He says, you know, of course I don't want you to go, Daniel, but, the law is the law. You know? So he just says, I just hope your God takes care of you. Right? I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, if I may, I'm just a light, since it's right after Purim, I'm just a light. Because Esti, my daughter Esti, was once played this role in a play. At the end of the play, Aladdin... Remember, he finds out that this guy his daughter loves is Aladdin, but he's a commoner. So he says, the law of the land is you can't marry him, so I'm sorry. But then he wakes up and he says, wait a second, I'm the sultan. You know what I'm saying? In other words,
you can make a prince.
It's not the law anymore, okay? Am I sultan or am I sultan, right? So why can't Achashverosh say that? Like, you know, I know I signed it, but hey, I'm Achashverosh. I'm the king. Right? So but that's not how things work here, because that would imply some degree of infallibility that to move away from the infallibility clause. Okay, so Esther something happens to Esther. She becomes transformed in the end of chapter 4, not unlike the transformation of Rus in chapter 3 of that book, where her mother-in-law tells her, get dressed up, put on nice perfume, and wash up, and put on a nice dress. And when he wakes up, you see, you get to the man you want to marry. When he wakes up, he'll tell you everything you should do. Right? So when he wakes up, what proceeds to happen? She tells him everything that they need to do. Right? So this is what's happening with Esther here, and she tries to manipulate a situation whereby her husband is going to feel. I hope everyone appreciates how precarious this situation is, because if she has to get him to feel that Haman is in on something to kill him with her, right? That has the potential to backfire, right? Okay, Baruch Hashem, it doesn't. But okay, so what does she do? Achashverosh thinks that all she came to see him about was not that there's a special sale at Macy's that she'd like to send a card, but that she needs to have some private time with him at a drinking, a little mishteh yayin. Okay, beautiful. What's wrong with the king and his wife having a nice meal together? Because, but wait, I'd like Haman to be there. Right? Which makes Haman very happy. Right? He thinks he's in good stead, not only with the king, but also with the queen. Which can never hurt, right? So he goes home and tells everyone how wonderful it is. So it's interesting. There's a Gemara in Maseches Chulin, not Megillah, that asks Esther min haTorah minayin, Haman min haTorah minayin, Mordechai min haTorah minayin. Where are the hints to these three characters? And if you were amazed, how come there's no Gemara Yecheskel min haTorah minayin, you know, Shmuel min haTorah minayin, Daniel min haTorah minayin?
His name is mentioned multiple times throughout the book.
Okay, so in those books, it's very no one thought of asking the question. But in Esther, you know, since there were those who questioned the canonicity of Esther, so Gemara feels I'd like to see that the Torah itself hints at these books. So where is the hint to Haman in the book? So it says, it's obviously it's a drash. It's not related to Haman whatsoever, but it is a connector. It's interesting. You know where it is? What story? Is there a hint to Haman?
The first story.
In the first story, in the Garden of Eden, God commanded not to eat from a tree. Mm-hmm. Right? And man ate from the tree. Haman prepares a tree for someone else to eat from, mm-hmm. and he ends up eating from it, right? Okay, but here is the Lashon. When God confronts man with the rebelliousness, if you look at the pasuk, it says, mm-hmm. right, Hamin ha'etz asher tzivisi lebilti achol mimenu achalta. And the word Hamin looks like Haman. Right? Haman ha'etz asher tzivisi, like Haman, the tree that you weren't supposed to eat from. You thought this tree is for someone else. You know, you're going to eat from it, right? But I think it goes beyond this. It really goes beyond this. Adam and Chava were put into a world situation where they could eat from every tree on the planet. Or whatever was their planet in the garden. There's just one tree they couldn't eat from. Of course, we know that when you're a child, if you want to, you know, reverse psychology, you know, right? So you can have all everything in the world. And the Yetzirah is very convincing. The Yetzirah starts off by saying, putting into Chava's head, no, I can't eat from any of these trees, so I might as well, should I even bother trying to obey? He doesn't let me do anything, right? if he does not eat from that one, it's like he does not eat from any of them. What are you talking about? You have everything. Right? And I'm saying, a child can be very satisfied with 100 pieces of licorice, but give the sibling 101 and the whole world will fall apart. Right? So this is what's going on with Haman. Haman has everything. He's second in command. He's the only person the king turns to for advice. He's got 10 sons to speak of, and probably more. He's probably living in the most opulent of places and circumstance, and he's got everything, and everyone bows to him. But that's the nature of things. When you have all of that, just the one thing can send you off. So that's Haman min HaTorah minayin. And Haman, everything is going so well for him. Think of the insecurity of this man. That with all of that, this one thing that right? Okay, you sometimes you can see what if things are going well. How could this little thing bother you? This little thing can't bother you, right? Simple question. Yeah. Yes, Moshe.
Do you think Esau? I mean, Haman got this from his relative Esau. Is this the nature of things? He's coming through the genealogy, Esau.
So I'll tell you this. Medrash Rabbah, this collection of Midrashim on the Torah and the five Megillot. Medrash Rabbah on Esther is a masterpiece. It is a real if you have a chance to just go through, don't even go through about the whole Medrash Rabbah, just do the Torah Tzimimus. Torah Tzimimus, it'll take you 2 hours if you go through, to go through all of them. Just that's it. Just go through the the Torah Tzimimus, right? Mm-hmm. And for the first two prokim is a lot, but the last 8 prokim goes quickly. This is what Medrash Rabbah does in Esther. It is just a narrative masterpiece. It has scores of places where Esther reminds you of similar behavior elsewhere in the Torah, in the Tanakh, mostly in Bereishis with Yosef's brothers, with Esav, with Yaakov, and right. So I would say, Moshe, you're onto something, but the Medrash says it in a different way, though. The Medrash says that Haman's behavior is actually recompense for what Yaakov did to Esav. Not the way Esav is behaving, but what Yaakov did to Esav. And there you have a linguistic connection, because when Esav heard that his younger brother took his place, the reaction the Torah describes for how he cried... Is the same expression as the reaction that the author of Esther gives for Mordechai's reaction to hearing of Haman's decree? Right? How do we know Haman is a direct descendant of Esav? Because Esav had a grandson named Amalek. Amalek had a descendant who was the king of Amalek. His name was Agog, and Haman is constantly referred to as Haman HaAgogi. So that's how Chazal understood that Esav and Haman are connected.
Yeah, I thought something similar when Esav made
Yaakov and Shishi
wrote a similar attitude.
Well, but not, yeah, Vayivez Esav Esav Achorah, just...
The other thing is, maybe Esther's idea how to undermine Haman worked so well because Haman really did want that. Because if you think about it, if he may have hated Mordechai, but if he had anyone to be jealous of, it was probably Ahasuerus.
Yeah, so the
one person that had more than him that he wanted to.
Right, so that this is why Ahasuerus can't sleep at night. Remember when he has trouble sleeping, because for the queen to say to put her life in danger. Why do you put your life in danger to see the king? He knows, she knows the rule, right? Mm-hmm. So you come to really Esther. That's all. Just you came to me. What if I wasn't in such a good mood? You put your life in danger to have a wine party with Haman? Wow. All right, but Ahasuerus is probably worried about his next backgammon game. He's not thinking of that, right? So Ahasuerus goes along with it, and at that party, he says, "Okay, Esther, you said you would ask me what's your request. Now, what do you think Ahasuerus thinks her request is going to be?" Maybe we shouldn't even bother. Maybe he doesn't care. I don't know.
Well,
what's she going to ask for? Some jewelry?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. You need to give half the kingdom.
He says, I give half the kingdom. Of course, Chazal say what's halfway between Hodu and Kush? Yerushalayim. Okay, so then the second day she says at the party tomorrow I'll let you know what it is, but I want Haman there again. So that's when he can't sleep that night. That's when he can't sleep that night. So Ahasuerus is, you know, he does know how to get angry on a whim. He's a very impetuous person in this book, right? It's not just, I think I said last time, in the beginning of the story, he lets his best friend convince him to kill his wife. At the end of the story, he lets his wife convince him to kill his best friend. But the impetuosity, the impulsiveness that it's done. He goes, oh yeah, that, I mean, just a half hour ago, you invited Haman to this party, mm-hmm. maybe worried about why he's coming to the party, what's going to happen. But then circumstances just changed so quickly that when they said, oh yeah, that's the tree he wanted to hang Mordechai, who saved your life, by the way, he goes, okay, tlo'uhu. Don't waste a perfectly good tree. Right? Right? So, just to say, you know, just, so hang on, go ahead. It's not how a king should not take things like that so quick. It's just, right? When David reacts, Chai Hashem ki ben moves ho yishahu says os. When does he say that? As the Lord lives, the man you just described should die. Betakeves yishalem arbatayim. When he heard the right, when he heard the parable about the, really? Stealing a sheep gets you the death penalty? Right? Of course he's pronouncing the, he says, Atah ish, you're that man. Right, and that's where he differentiates himself from Shaul. He just says, immediately says Chatasi. Right? Okay, so, but the king can't act with that kind of impetuosity. Right? So Esther plays all the cards very, very wisely, and she gets him just jealous enough to think during the night, why is my wife inviting Haman two days in a row to a party? What is she going to ask me? So he's probably, the second time around, he's probably worried, thinking, what's she going to ask for? Right? Because I already told her, whatever you ask for, I'll give you. And you know, I don't make mistakes. Right? So what is she going to ask for? Right? She knows exactly how to talk to him. I'm asking for my life, and if it was anything less than my life, it wouldn't be worth any harm to my dear king and the kingdom. And, right? She learned on the job how to be great at this, not just to be a great queen, but how to be a great wife of Ahasuerus. Right? So she gets him jealous. She gets him thinking. Right? And he's worried. He's thinking that they said, really, Haman and the Esther would kill me after all I did for him. And after all I did for her, and everything I've offered her, they would come around to kill me? It's inconceivable that the two of them could possibly want to kill me and no one knows about it. Right? But, I mean, so you know what? If someone knows, I'm going to put a word out there that whoever saves my life gets the greatest honors. Right? Whoever saves my life, anyone who gives me information about an insurrection, and if it's found to be true, they'll be given great honors. So he says, you know what? I recall someone saved my life. Right? I forgot, you know, it doesn't say how many years ago it was, but I forgot what did he do. And so he calls immediately for his diaries. He has everything written down. It's called Sefer Divrei Hayamim. And he says, I'd like to look up and see, look back when someone saved my life. He said, oh, here it is, right here, page 1247. Look at that. He goes, well, who did it? Well, it says that your queen Esther, she said that someone she knew named Mordechai saved your life. It's a good thing she said it b'shem Mordechai, because if she just wanted to take credit herself, it wouldn't have been in the record that someone named Mordechai saved him, right? Mm-hmm. So, two...
She knew the halacha.
Well, that's where the halacha learns it from. it's circular, yes. The Gemara does that sometimes, by the way.
It does
it with Hadassah. Mm-hmm. It says, "How do you know Hadassim? If you're there's a prophecy in Zechariah involving Hadassim, and it says Hadassim represents Tzadikim. How do you know? Because Esther's name was Hadassah, and she must have been a Tzadikis. But in another Gemara, it says, "How do you know that Esther Hadassah is a Tzadikis?" And it says, "Because of the Hadassim in Zechariah." So. Anyway, there are other cases like that, indeed, as Tosfos points out, that it's the way of the Gemara to do those kind of things. All right, but she's just brilliant in her part, because by reading the old report of her saving his life in the name of Mordechai, so she clears herself now. Mm-hmm. All right, so he's going to think, you know, why am I inviting Haman? Okay, clear up. I would never do something like that to you. But Haman, so the king says, I have a way to test Haman. I'm going to ask him tomorrow, what shall be done for a person that I want to give honors? Right? Now, he already decided the honors are going to Mordechai. But I'm going to ask Haman what he thinks I should do for such a person. Knowing full well what the reader finds out, which is one of the ways the Gemara says that this book was written prophetically. Because if it wasn't written prophetically, finish my sentence.
Can't know what Haman's thinking.
How could anyone know what Haman was thinking? Right? Clear? You understand?
Excuse me.
Vayomer Haman b'libo. That's how we know that the book belongs in the Bible, that it was written with prophecy. Okay? Okay, so but Ahasuerus is clever enough to know that when he asks Haman, how should I honor someone that I would like to bestow such a way. He knows that Haman's response is he's thinking of me. Mm-hmm. Right, you agree?
Mm-hmm.
So when Haman goes so overboard, and Haman goes so over the top, right, with all of these descriptions of what you should do,
mm-hmm.
Ahasuerus is
suspicious.
It's more and more suspicious about this guy. Right? So of course he has to now ride through the ride through the town with calling out to Gemara has an amazing conversation between Haman and Mordechai that it says that Haman was commanded to give Mordechai a haircut to groom him for this ride, right? So Mordechai is trying to get up on the barber chair, but he can't because he's too weak. He's been fasting and he's been praying. Remember, we just had these 3 days of fasting. And so Haman says, "Okay, I'll bend down on the floor and stamp on my back so you can get up on the chair." So Mordechai gets on his back and kicks him in the head with his heel as he's getting into the chair. So Haman says, "Oh, that's what you do when I'm down. Doesn't it say in your Bible, 'Bin pol oyivcha al tismach'? When your enemy is down, don't gloat, right?" So Mordechai's answer is interesting. What would you think you should answer? Bin pol oyivcha al tismach.
What's that?
I'm asking you. What do you think? What should Mordechai answer?
I'm a Jewish enemy.
Yeah, that's what he does say.
Well,
you say that it's not talking about an enemy like you. It's enemies like you, va'ata al bamosemo sidroch. It's interesting, in Akkadian, bama means a back. He hits him in the back while he's bending over. Anyway, so Mordechai gets driven through the streets, and of course, Haman goes back home, avel v'chafuri rosh. But things are going to get a lot worse from here. So he finally shows up the second day at the feast, and you know what happens there. So Esther is she brilliantly plays the part. She gets rid of Haman, but there's a problem in Persia.
The decree,
right? There is a
decree,
that has to happen. So that's why we have this holiday now, because if the decree was just rescinded, because a king can just say, "Okay, I made the decree, now I rescind the decree." We're finished. Let's go on. But she has to turn to him, and now I'll just conclude with maybe a little Purim Torah. But she asks twice for everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, even after Haman's 10 sons are dead,
yeah.
She asks to kill the 10 sons of Haman. All right, don't be so amazed with that. The Bible does that often, where it records something twice from two different standpoints. I will tell you that there is a Medrash that says that she was asking for the future. Mm-hmm. If there are anti-Semites in the future, and haters of our people in the future, that you do the same to them. Okay, and maybe some of you know, in the first ruling of in the Nuremberg trials, 10 Nazis were hanged. Right. On Purim Day. 1946. And the Eish HaTorah points out, you know, the little letters in that whole list of the 10, as it spells out, 1946. Really amazing. But, okay, that's Purim Torah. But why she had to say it twice is that she had to be emphatic, because it's the simple pshat. Ahasuerus did not act immediately upon this. You know, yesterday I was saying some Purim Torah that, you know, you have the word Hamelech, Hamelech, like 100 times in the book, right? Hamelech is the same gematria as Haman. You know, Haman is Tzorer Kol HaYehudim. You ever see the last time he's mentioned, he's called Tzorer Kol HaYehudim. He's the enemy of all the Jews. What does that mean? Of course, he wanted to kill all of them. It's that the Jews outside of Shushan felt confident that his decree wouldn't reach them. And the Jews in walled cities outside of Shushan felt, we'll defend ourselves, we're living in a walled city, we're covered, we're going to be okay. And that's Ramban, the first Ramban in his Kedushim to Maseches Megillah, explains that that's why we celebrate the holiday on two different days. To teach that a Jew threatened anywhere is a Jew threatened everywhere. Right? They're not just threatening you in this place. That's why Glenn has his Tisha B'Av event at Isaiah Wall, because it's not just Tisha. Okay, we're here, we're pretty okay here. But if it's going on in Syria, it can go on here. Because the people who do it in Syria or Iran or wherever it is are not satisfied just to do it there, to take care of the Jews there. They'll go to Bulgaria. They'll go to, you know. I'm sorry, Johnny.
No, I was going to say, it's interesting that partly they should have learned that in Sefer Shoftim by Shelah Binyamin, right?
Explain? Well, I'm not sure. I'm not following.
No. Like, they all were supposed to take care of one another in Binyamin, right? Almost like the Shevet.
They make a shvua not to marry them.
It's almost wiped out, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, okay, to Mitakin that, to fix that, okay, Mordechai is from Shevet Binyamin.
Mm-hmm. I think well before Mordechai, Shaul, also from Shevet Binyamin, fixes that. Remember, by cutting up that animal into 12 pieces, and he sent one to every tribe, and he said, I'll cut up all your animals if you don't join everybody, every tribe, to save the people from Yabesh Gilead. Yes?
So, it's interesting. I don't know if you can answer this, but what did Ahasuerus actually do to change things? Was it just the fact that he told the Jews to defend themselves?
He helped them. He gave them the wherewithal to defend themselves. But they would have been sitting ducks. Now it says that there were a lot of casualties on the Persian side. But some of the casualties on our side too. You know,
state like was going to assist like the side that was fighting the Jews and then assisting.
It's so crazy. It's that the system is so insane. Why make them fight a battle? I mean, there's 54,000 that perish in Shushan. That's a huge battle.
It doesn't say how many Jews perished.
No. So, the battle has to take place because I signed it. That's a little crazy, right? All right, but that's how it works there. So, that's why we have two different days to set to celebrate. Yes, Moshe.
So on Saturday night and Sunday morning, when we use the Noah Makers to Haman's name is mentioned, could we halakhically add Hamas, all of our enemies, to that name? Would we be adding to the Komash or taking away from it? Would that be halakhically inappropriate to add modern-day enemies?
So You're asking a deep question. A malek is not to be genealogically traced. In fact, it says in Divrei Hayamim that a malek has ceased to exist as an identifiable people. So there are some thinkers who feel that a malek is no longer a genealogy. It's an ideology.
It's a type person.
So you have to go back to Parsha Tshalach, look at Perushim like Abravanel and the like, who ask the question, in what way does a malek distinguish itself from other enemies? I mean, historically speaking, the Philistines, Egyptians, caused us a whole lot more harm than the Amalekim.
Did I see, like, Haman and Amalek, maybe the Nazis also, like, the distinction you can make with them, they had absolutely nothing to gain from killing the Jews, and they even were willing to sacrifice...
Even something to lose.
Amalek sacrificed their lives, Haman was willing to sacrifice a huge amount of money, the Nazis, like, diverted resources they needed.
Certainly at the end of the war. Certainly at the end of the war, no doubt. I have a book at home. It's a history book. It's very sophisticated. It's called What If? And you can imagine where we're going with this.
Yeah.
Is that it has a discussion that if the Nazis had no anti-Jewish policy whatsoever in World War II and behaved towards Jews the same way they did in World War I, that they would have hands down would have won World War II.
But they didn't have the money. They had to get it from the Jews.
So that's the other... They do take that other side. They said that they got lots of money and paintings and gold and
silver. They took everything from the Jews.
Yeah, yes. And I know you're well placed to know that firsthand. But they would have had thinkers that would have remained in Germany all that time and would have helped them create the atom bomb.
But there was no meaning to Nazi party then.
But I'm just saying, if there was no anti-Jewish policy, just leave it. Let's fight without any, let's say a Nazi party, whatever. I don't know, but that's obviously what led to the war. I'm just saying. I'm just saying that just to prove Baruch's point, is that the hatred of the Jew was so great that hatred will cause you to harm your own best interests. And I see much of that in the Arab world too today. You don't see it manifest in much of the Arab world. Is that? Imagine if they had no anti-Israel policy from 1947. What a Gan Eden all the Middle East could be today. With all that oil wealth, together with Israeli ingenuity and sharing, but it's it's much easier to blame all of your political failures and all other failures with all the gifts God gave you on the ground. Blame it on that one little land of Israel. But what's really confounding is that much of the rest of the world goes along with it. Right, the answer is obvious. There are a billion and 400 million of them and barely 8 million of us in Israel. But so just Lamaisa, but that's really what it is that Haman ends up hurting himself. And really, if the original Amalek in Parshat Beshalach, who are they? They're your Esav's descendants, but they are traced by just based on the year that Egyptologists give for what's known as the period of humiliation, and humiliation of Egypt, where they are overrun by shepherd tribes called the Hyksos. Now, admittedly, there are some historians who think that the Hyksos were in Egypt earlier, like in the time of Yosef. But be that as it may, according to this position, and they give the year 1312 BCE as the year of the takeover, which is exactly Yetzias Mitzrayim. So if that's who Amalek is, they're on their way into Egypt to carve up and divide up this fallen empire. Gesunte hate. We just made it easy pickings for you. What do you want with us? They weakened themselves from their ultimate objective, which was to get into Egypt and take over. So the Nile is yours and everything around it is yours. We don't want it. We never want it.
Military.
We're out of here.
No military.
So why would you want with us? Such is their hatred. Right?
Going after the story and all is done, they still stayed in Persia. They didn't make Aliyah.
Yeah, that's a sad part of the story, because as we know, here in America,
yeah,
There's two parts to making Aliyah, and I say it in it's a Haftorah. It says, "Uva'u ha'ovdim be'eretz Ashur, v'hanidochim be'eretz Mitzrayim, yishtachavu l'Hashem b'harakodesh b'Yerushalayim." All of the exiles in Assyria and Egypt will return to Egypt. Will return to Israel. So the question is, just Assyria and Egypt? That's all? What about South America? What about France? What about Australia? Just Ashur and Mitzrayim? What's the Sheol talking about? So this is a Mamre Chazal. It's a Medrash that says that Ashur and Mitzrayim are paradigmatic of different types of nations. Ashur means to be happy. Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecha Meitzar. Mitzrayim means to be afflicted and to be pressed and oppressed. So there'll be two different types of lands that Jews will find themselves. The Ashur countries will be like Canada, Great Britain, America, Australia, right, the West. And the Meitzar countries, there were many more of them, but Baruch Hashem, the Jews have left Yemen. I don't know how many Jews are still left in Algeria or Morocco or Tunisia. You know, maybe there's Chabad in these places, I don't know, but
only in Morocco, maybe.
Morocco, there's still.
Yeah, Morocco, okay, but not that.
Not in the others.
Not that
place. Iran still has its
Islamic. Yeah, Italy, but not Chabad.
But only the old ones.
Okay. Yes. Anyway, so
only old people.
So the so that they represent two different types of countries where Jews will return, from which Jews will return. And the Jews can go, come and go whenever they want from the first type of countries. It's just that they're very happy there. The Jews can't go from the other types of countries. They just can't get out. Or if they're allowed out, you have to leave every single thing behind. You can't take a single thing with you. How easy it is to do that with your whole family, right?
So it can be done.
I know. That's what you had to do.
So assuming that was the issue, that's why they were threatened and almost annihilated, or was it assimilation?
So what's interesting is that the assimilation didn't help enamor them to the Hamans of the world.
No.
Right? It didn't help. In fact, my reading of the early Nuremberg laws is that the ones they went after were the Jews who wanted to be more German than anything else. Mm-hmm. You can't marry a Jewish or a German woman. What, I need Hitler to say that I shouldn't marry a German woman? Right? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Seems to me, and from anecdotes as well. Remember Yehudis? She was from Palmach. What was her last name?
Frankel.
Right, she said her husband, I think her husband's father, they're from Germany, right?
Yeah, they were from Frankfurt.
Yeah, she told me some stories there also, that the real problem was the Jews who wanted to be more German than anything else. Of course, they were going to go after everybody, but the issue is that the Jews who enjoyed Achashverosh's meal, the Jews who were probably trying to be more Persian than anything else, it didn't stop them. It's a famous drash, Elu, the Elish Shmos B'nai Yisrael Haboim Mitzrayim. What do you mean Haboim Mitzrayim? They came 200 years earlier. They will always think that you just came today. No matter how long you've been there and how much you want to assimilate, you're right. So don't try. Right? So, but that was the problem. At the end, let's close with this. At the very end of the Haggadah, at the end of Megillah, it says that Mordechai was beloved to all of his people. It says Lerov Echov. See on page 1261. It says Ki Mordechai haYehudim Mishne laMelech Achashverosh veGadol haYehudim v'Ratzui Lerov Echov. So the English translation is correct here. It says found favor with the multitude of his brethren.
Yes.
The Gemara makes a drash. What could it also mean?
Not all of them.
Most of the Jews liked him. 51% liked him.
Yeah.
What does that mean, the Tzuri Lerov? It should say Tzuri Lekol Echov.
Yeah.
Doesn't it say about Esther, no says Chen Lechol Roeha? Really? Is everybody, if everybody likes you, you're trying too hard?
Yes.
No, someone's got to not like you. And then it's impossible. Right? Anyway, so what does it mean that Ritzui Lerov Echov? So the Gemara says Pirish Mimenu Mitzah Sanhedrin, that the rabbis were not happy. That look, I know some people today who will always say I didn't vote for Gore Lieberman because I didn't want a Jew to be in the, you know, in such a high position. They'll always blame us if something goes wrong. They won't give us credit if something goes right, but they'll certainly be there to blame us if something goes wrong. So there's some people who would not vote for a Jew for president. They won't, for, you know, I don't want a Jew so high up. So, all right, whatever it is. But Mordechai's position certainly would bode well for the Jews, and it made their position in Persia to be somewhat, certainly politically more positive, certainly than having Amon in that position, right?
Yeah.
But it made Jews a little too comfortable in Persia, so that when Ezra called them home to go to Israel, very, you know, comparatively speaking, very few Jews came.
42,000?
Right? 42,360 Jews came. That's a small tribe 1,000 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's just, it's just, you know, as I've said so many times, but also the bad situation in Israel. Israel was very bad at the time. At the time of the return, Israel was desolate. It's because the plan that Yirmiyahu had hoped was that Jews would remain in Israel all those years. A small community was supposed to remain, but they killed Gedaliah, and that was, you know, that ruined things. Right? So the bottom line is Esther manipulates the situation very, very deftly. She changes history. And the book is called Megillat Esther. And I compared it to yesterday in the shir. I'll just conclude with this. It's like when Devorah tells Barak to, you know, to arrange an army to fight against the Canaanites, he says, "I'll only go if you go with me." So she says, "Okay, you didn't want to do it. Okay, now the glory is going to come to a woman." In this book, there's also in the beginning of the story, there's when Ahasuerus has some doubts what to do. He calls together the Sanhedrin and he asks them, "What should I do about my rebellious wife?" So I must tell you, it's very doubtful that Ahasuerus did ask the Sanhedrin. But let me tell you what the deeper meaning of this medrash is. The rabbis responded that they were worried about advising the king, because if we tell him to get rid of her, and then tomorrow he wakes up and he says, "Oh, I miss my wife," he'll blame us for giving him the wrong advice. And if we tell him to keep her, right, and then tomorrow he regrets it, and he'll be angry with us. So you know what? We'll just punt on this. We won't advise him. We'll just say, since our temple has been destroyed, council has departed from us, and we can't help you. Right? So that denotes some type of passivity of the men in the story. That they sort of, they, you know, Mordechai has this grand plan, but it's Esther's to craft and to execute. So the book is hers, the story is hers, and it's written by her. So Mordechai is, and I mentioned this linguistically. The book has an inordinate amount of nifal words, and I gave out a sheet yesterday. It's just crazy how many. Vayimotzei, vayivukash, nifal, hofal, pual, passive verbs abound in this book. And then you get up to chapter 4 and 5 where Esther takes charge. No more. It's all in the active voice. It's binyan kal or binyan hifal. Causative or pal. So there is metamorphosis. It's Esther's metamorphosis. And I think it's another one of the pshatim of Nekevot HaSoviv Gavir. The prophecy in Yirmiyahu that before our redemption, the women shall take charge.
Yeah.
Right? That's why the woman encircles the groom at the wedding from this prophecy. Okay, we'll stop with this. Next week, we're going to move on. I want to start doing David, because we did Chana and Penina and Elkanah. So let's do David. We have David. What can we say? It's good to be the king. But if you have him, we're going to do Abigail, we'll do Michal, we'll do Bathsheba. There's what to do. Okay, we'll do David and his wife.